mutton chops and a wiry build. He wore the kind of expensive suit Flora only saw in the best parts of Landfall, with a gold chain hanging from the breast pocket and a pair of spectacles perched on the tip of his nose. He had papers in one hand, reading them while toying with a big Boz knife, the tip of which was buried in his gouged desk. He set the paper down and looked up as Flora came up the stairs. She waited for her escorts to take her weapons and frisk her, but instead the Palo guards retreated back down to the bar. Bert leaned forward, grinning at her, and opened a box on his desk. "Cigar?"
"I would, thanks."
Flora took one, figuring that she might as well enjoy a few minutes before the bastard tried to have her killed, and allowed him to light the end.
"Your name is..."
"Verundish," Flora said, using the name of an old military colleague. "I'm guessing you're... Brown Bear Bert?"
"That's me,"
Bert said cheerfully.
"You're not very bear-like." "Just Bert will do," he said. "Kill one big Iron Hook grizzly with a lucky shot, and suddenly people make it a nickname."
He spoke Adran without an accent, suspiciously so. A lot of Palo spoke Adran, but he sounded like he'd been born there. Laura puffed on the cigar. The tobacco was good. Very good. She held it out, looking along the length for a tobacconist's mark. It was a small spear with a circle around it. Nothing she recognized. She waved away a face full of smoke.
"That's a good cigar. Little place off the coast I invested in a while back. Things go well, they'll be selling them as far away as Strenland in a couple of years."
Flora took another puff, then set the cigar carefully on the ashtray on Bert's desk. She couldn't let herself relax, not here. She'd already been introduced to the way people do business here by Jezzy's shovels, and even someone as skilled as she could wind up face down in a ditch if she wasn't careful.
"Is there something I can help you with, Bert?" "Verundish, you said?"
"That's right." Bert got to his feet, still puffing on his cigar, and walked over to the balcony to look down to the bar below. He returned to his desk, pouring a glass of whiskey and offering it to her. She declined, and Bert shrugged and took a sip.
"Why are you here, Verundish?"
"Came looking for work."
"That's what you say. Yet you've already turned down my competitor, Jezzy."
"I'm not looking for that kind of work," Flora said. "This town is going to explode one of these days, anyone can feel it, and I have no interest in being in the middle. I'd like something a little quieter." Bert took a seat, throwing his feet up on his desk.
"Your companion, too? He's looking for something quiet."
"Well, that's the plan."
Bert shifted in his seat. "See, now that's what's so strange to me. Your kind doesn't really attract quiet, do they? You're too valuable for quiet work."
"My kind?" Flora was genuinely puzzled.
Did he mean Adran's? "Powder mages."
Flora stiffened, forcing herself not to reach for a pistol and blow Bert's head off right here and now. She, Flora Flint, was a celebrity and a renowned general. But there were still a lot of people in the world who had it out for powder majors without a name.
"I'm not sure what you're talking about."
Bert rolled his eyes.
"Don't play coy, Verundish. I've got a knack on my payroll that can sense powder mages. Not a very useful knack, but he's a smart man, so I keep him around. He earned his pay when you walked into town."
Flora's fingers crept toward her pistol. Behind the desk, with his line of sight, he wouldn't be able to tell. Bert continued before she could respond.
"Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not threatening you or your companion. I'm not an idiot. Nor do I actually want to know what two powder mages are doing out here on the frontier looking for quiet work.
If you're keeping your heads down, I'm not the type of fool to bring that to anyone's attention.
So what do you want?
Vlora asked coldly. Same as Jesse wants. I just happen to know what you're worth.
Bert took his feet down and leaned forward.
Come work for me, the two of you, and I'll pay you 5,000 kroner up front and 50,000 the first day of next spring. Each.
Flora couldn't help but raise her eyebrows. He actually did know what a powder mage was worth, though he wasn't sure who Flora really was. That was an immense amount of money for a hired gun for 6 months of work. She wasn't interested, of course, but at least she didn't have to kill him. Yet. She shook her head. Bert frowned.
80,000.
Pardon?
Same offer. 80,000 kroner.
Flora swore inwardly. If she really was a hired gun, she would jump on the offer in an instant.
It's not about the money, I'm afraid.
What's it about?
She tried to come up with a better excuse, but found herself grasping at straws.
Nobody turned down that kind of money.
I don't want to get involved, she said emphatically. I want quiet work, easy work. I'm not here to show off.
Ah!
Bert puffed on his cigar, examining her through half-closed eyes.
You're hiding from something.
He raised his hands in a peaceful gesture.
Again, I'm making no threats. Just an observation.
Flora knew the risk of such an excuse. If Bert wanted, he could try to blackmail her. But if he was as smart as he seemed, threatening a powder mage was probably low on his to-do list.
It's not personal. If it makes you feel any better, your competitor isn't going to get a rise out of either me or my companion, no matter how much she offers to pay. There are things worth more than money.
Oh, we agree on that, at least. A little quiet is priceless, Bert said thoughtfully.
He stood up again, clearly frustrated, and paced behind his desk. If you're not getting involved, you should probably get out of town.
I'm not going anywhere until a judge clears my companion.
I'd suggest you reconsider, Bert said.
Is that a threat? Flora asked, keeping her tone neutral.
Not at all. It's a friendly warning. You're right when you say this town is hot. Fighting will break out eventually, and when it does, anyone with a weapon will be a target. What's more, Jesse doesn't take no for an answer. You're going to be a liability for her and, frankly, for me. I've got your assurances that you won't get involved, but I don't know you. You could be lying. Or things could just change.
That sounds like a threat. Bert showed her his empty hands.
Cross my heart. Just friendly advice.
I don't know you, either.
Touché! Bert chuckled. I think we each know where the other stands now, so I'm not going to waste any more of your time. One last offer. Come work for me.
Flora tensed, looking over her shoulder. The sentence was too ominous not to be the precursor to some sort of retaliation if she said no. But the two of them were alone. Bert continued.
How about this? You sleep on it tonight. Talk to your friend at the town jail and chew on this bit of information. Jesse already has herself a powder mage. I'll pay you two whatever you want to kill the bastard.
Flora rocked back. So that's why Bert was so anxious to hire her and Taniel. Two powder mages to counter one. It was surprising information and more helpful than Bert knew. A powder mage could sense another, so if Jesse didn't know what she and Taniel were yet, she would soon. And that complicated the pit out of their mission. Things just kept getting worse and worse. Flora stood up, straightening her jacket.
I'll take that under advisement. Thank you for being polite.
Of course, Bert said, raising his cigar. But lest you think I'm too polite, I have people I trust who know what you are. If a bullet happens to find my brain, they'll make sure that whatever you're running from is able to find you. Understand?
Flora smiled at him tightly. This man was not an idiot, unfortunately.
Good afternoon, she told him.
Chapter 25. Mikkel followed Tennick into the Capitol building at about noon. It was a weekend, and the halls were mostly empty, with just a few couriers and soldiers present. Other than when he handed himself over to Yarrett at the beginning of this mess, it was the first time Mikkel had been back in the building since the occupation, and he allowed himself to take in the small details that had changed along with the government. Red-on-black Dionysus flags flew from banisters and high windows, while much of the upholstery on hallway benches had been changed to match. Everything that had the old regime symbols and colours had been either replaced or defaced. As a spy, Mikkel was used to being an outsider in enemy territory, but it still felt very strange not to see the familiar sunflower yellow of the Fortrasten flags, or the rose symbol of the Black Hats. He knew that they were just cosmetic changes, but they troubled him more than he'd expected. He did not allow his unease to show on his face as he followed Tennick down the long main hall.
"Who will I meet at this war game?" he asked.
Tennick flipped his coin without breaking stride, catching it every time.
"It's hard to say. Most of us haven't been able to attend the game since we left home. This one was put together by the Chalazi household. Chalazi is the Minister of Finance. I'm guessing, since we're in the Capitol building, that it's not exactly open to the public. You guess right. It'll be mostly government bureaucrats, senior household members who make some excuse to get away from their duties for a few hours. I'll stake my ration card on Fagula, attending. One of the players is her cousin."
They stopped once as a privileged and his retinue passed by. Mikkel mimicked Tennick's bowed head before they continued their trip down the hall.
"Will there be any of those?" Mikkel asked, glancing over his shoulder. "Privileged? I doubt it. I'll be surprised if we even see any of the minor names. It'll be mostly cupbearers, captains of the guard, stewards, and doormen."
"The people who really run the Empire, you mean?"
This could be a very good experience for Mikkel. He needed to keep his eyes and ears open, but not lose focus on the current issue with Fagula. Tennick gave him a sly smile.
"We would never presume."
"I'm sure you wouldn't.
What role do the privileged play in households, by the way?" "They don't belong to households," Tennick said. "Technically, all privileged are property of the Emperor."
"I saw a privilege with Carsedial yesterday."
Tennick wrinkled his nose.
"Sedial is different. He speaks with the Emperor's voice on this expedition, so the privileged report to him. I didn't see this privileged, but I'm surprised Sedial openly has one as an escort. Emperor's voice or not, he has so far been careful not to flaunt his power on this expedition, lest he encourage several of the lesser households to ally against him."
Tennick shook his head.
"I'll look into the matter."
They rounded a corner and continued on for another 100 paces, where they reached a double set of ornate doors. Tennick pushed one open without knocking, revealing a room that belied the quiet of the rest of the building. What had once been the foreign dignitary room had been, at first glance, converted into a boxing arena. It was already well suited to observation, with high banks of windows and tiered seating
where bureaucrats could observe important meetings. More chairs and another set of tiered seating had been added all around the room, and an enormous table where Lindert had met with Carcediel had been removed. The arena-like feel was what reminded Mikel of boxing. The room was filled with people, stinking from so many bodies, filled with the noise of their cheers, jeers, and the placing of wagers. Tenek shouldered his way through the crowd, pulling Mikel along behind him until they reached the object of everyone's attention. In the centre of the room, where the enormous meeting table had once stood, was an octagon over 20 feet across and filled with smaller octagonal tiles of various colours. Carved ivory and jade figurines stood on some of those tiles. It was, to Mikel's eyes, the likeness of a general's war map, and it didn't take him long to realize that the two people standing beside the octagon were the generals in this war game. The players moved around the map freely, using long sticks to carefully adjust the positions of the figurines in a seemingly preordained order. A third person, like the referee in a boxing match, occasionally would reach out with a long pincer stick to remove one of the pieces. Mikel was immediately taken with the game. Tenek had explained the basics the night before, and he thought the concept sounded slow and boring. But this moved quickly, each player taking their turn in a matter of seconds, while the crowd's noise grew from silence to whispers to a roar, all depending on the actions of the players. He tore his eyes away from the game as Tenek tugged on his sleeve. They moved back through the crowd to the edge of the room, climbing up into an open spot on the tiered seating, where they could get a decent look at the room. Mikel took one look around and immediately realized how out of place he looked. His blonde-dyed hair and his part Cressian, part Palo features made him stand out in a room full of redheads. Even his suit, brown cotton trousers and jacket, seemed drab and strange among all the teal and ivory worn by the Dianais. More than a few were watching him as he did a slower examination of the room. Some whispered to each other curiously, while others were obviously annoyed at his presence. "Tell me," Mikel said out of the corner of his mouth, "do foreigners often attend these games?" "Not that I can recall." Mikel cursed himself for not thinking about how out of place he would be, and Tenek for not warning him. He needed to stay in the shadows while he looked for Taniel's informant, not damn well stand on a stage. He forced himself to ignore the glares and the whispers. "Names," he told Tenek. "I need to know who these people are. There's a lot of people here. I'm going to have to learn them eventually." "Where do you want me to start?" Tenek asked. Mikel's wandering gaze finally found his target. Forgula stood about 20 yards away, down at the other end of the tiered seating, with her neck craned to see over the heads of people in front of her. To his surprise, he recognized the woman just behind her. "I thought you said there wouldn't be a privileged here," Mikel said. "Eh?" Tenek looked around. "Where do you see a privileged?" "Behind Forgula. That's the woman I mentioned earlier." Tenek searched for a moment. "Ah, Sheen Ictracia. I should have known." "About what?" "A privileged with Sedil. She's his granddaughter." Mikel made a mental note that this was not someone he wanted to cross paths with. "She's pretty." Tenek laughed softly. "They call her the People Eater." "Do I want to know why?" "She's survived 17 separate assassination attempts. The first was when she was 7. She strangled the assassin with a string from one of her nursery toys." Mikel let out a soft whistle. "Because of her grandfather. She's a member of the Imperial family and a privileged. She gained enemies simply by being born. Tennet clicked his tongue thoughtfully. Her nickname. It also has a double meaning. You know about privileged, right? The dumb dangerous. Not that. The sorcery. It makes them ravenous. For sex, Mikkel scoffed. I thought that was a myth. No myth, Tennet said. As far as I've been able to tell, our privileged are less discerning than yours. Try not to catch her eye. If you do, she will use you like a damp rag and discard you. Whether you survive the encounter will be left up to chance. Mikkel turned to look at Tennet, expecting a tongue-in-cheek smile, but the cupbearer was dead serious. You're joking. A friendly warning, Tennet said. He went on. The man beside her is a cupbearer for the Girotal household, Minister of Public Works. The woman behind her is a captain of the Sedial Household Guard. Tennet spent the next 10 minutes pointing out people and telling Mikkel their names, households, and their occupations. Mikkel repeated each name that was told to him, trying to get the pronunciations down and casting them to memory. Within minutes he was trying to juggle 2 dozen names. Soon that number doubled. The game below them carried on, and the noise in the room began to grow in pitch, suggesting to Mikkel that some sort of conclusion was forthcoming. Mikkel's eyes kept returning to Forgula. Tennet had described her as a capable woman, and as Mikkel examined her, he began to see through the deception of his first impression that she had a gentle face. While it was true that some baby fat still clung to her cheeks, she had the thin, hard body of an athlete, and her eyes were just as intense as those of the privileged standing behind her. She grimaced at the game, occasionally smiled, and once bore her teeth toward the players with an open malice. There was a weight to her right sleeve, suggesting to Mikkel that she carried a blackjack, the same weapon she'd beaten him with last week. His forehead and arm were finally beginning to heal, and he reminded himself not to allow this to get personal. He was here, he told himself, just until he could find Taniel's informant. The opportunity to have some vengeance on Forgula by disrupting whatever she was doing with Mahoosh was a secondary concern. Unfortunately, the informant's name, Mara, was not among those that Tennet shared with him by the time the roar of the spectators suddenly drowned out the next name that Tennet whispered into Mikkel's ear. Roughly half of the room broke out into a cheer, while others looked away with disgust and disappointment. Mikkel felt his own disappointment, swearing under his breath. He tried to remember what little Taniel had told him about Mara, that she was part of a Dianai's higher-up's retinue. Retinue, he decided, meant household. But now that he knew roughly how big a household could be, that information was practically useless. There had to be a more efficient way to do this. Mikkel discarded the thought and turned to Forgula, whom he saw shaking hands with the crowd.
Her cousin won, Mikkel said. Tennet nodded. He's a very good player, but he got lucky.
You were watching the game?
Weren't you? I was listening to you.
Tennet slapped him on the shoulder.
If you come to more games, you'll have to learn to talk and watch.
Good morning, he called to someone a few rows down the seating, waving a greeting. He whispered the person's name in Mikkel's ear, which Mikkel promptly forgot.
Mikkel's attention was still on Forgula as she began to move through the crowd, exchanging a few words here, touching an arm there, then a longer conversation. She snubbed one woman, warmly greeted another, then put her arm around a man who spoke in her ear. Mikkel noted the faces of each of the people she spoke with and how they interacted.
"This room smells like politics," he said to Tenik. "These games are the political underbelly of Dynais, aren't they?"
A moment of silence passed, and Mikkel turned to find Tenik watching him carefully.
"You're very perceptive."
"It's my job," Mikkel answered. "I have to know just enough about everything to keep from getting killed. And instinct tells me to get out of here as quickly as possible."
"Instinct?"
"Instinct. And the looks your compatriots are giving me. I'm unwelcome here."
"That is true."
Mikkel wondered again if coming here had been a mistake. He was a spy, and he should be operating from the shadows. Let the Dianese upper crust wonder about the foreign spy in Yaret's household, but keep himself hidden. But not all spying, he reminded himself, was from the shadows. Hiding in plain sight was a useful strategy, if it didn't get you killed. Someone passed him on their way down the tiered seating, knocking hard into his shoulder and almost throwing him to the ground. A word was hissed as Tenik caught him. Mikkel regained his balance.
"What does that mean?" Mikkel asked.
"He called you a dirty foreigner."
Tenik's eyes narrowed at the assailant's back.
"Is he an enemy of the household?" Mikkel asked.
"An ally, unfortunately. He's a footman for the Minister of Agriculture. I will speak to him later."
"Let it go," Mikkel suggested.
Tenik shook his head firmly. "You are a member of Yaret's household now, whether our allies like it or not. And someone like him," he nodded to the assailant, "is not high enough a station to get away with insulting you. His minister isn't even here. She's back in Dionysus, smooching the Emperor instead of helping with the cause."
"Just out of curiosity, who is high enough station to get away with insulting me?" Mikkel asked, eyeing Fugula as she continued to wind her way through the crowd.
He studied everyone she made contact with. Who knew about her contact with the Black Hats? Was there a conspiracy? Was she a traitor? Was her master vying for more power? Tenik considered the question for a moment before answering.
"That is a complicated answer.
If you are insulted, you should let it go. I can deal with it."
"That sounds like my mother telling me to ignore the boys who beat me up in school," Mikkel responded.
He caught the eye of another Dionysus staring in his direction, and realized with a start that it was Icthracia. The privileged was watching him with open curiosity, and Mikkel felt a shiver run down his spine.
"I think I've learned enough for one day," he said to Tenik. "We should go."
He began to head down the tiered seating, only to see Fugula directly below him, speaking urgently with a young woman in a soldier's uniform. Mikkel turned to work his way around her, just as she looked up toward him. He swore silently, resisting the urge to slink away, and decided to walk directly past her on his way out. He decided Fugula was someone to whom he shouldn't show weakness. Mikkel looked her in the eye and gave her his most charming smile. A look of disgust crossed her face.
"Tenik," she said sharply.
Tenik was just one step above and behind Mikkel.
"Good morning, Devin Fugula," he said, touching his forehead in greeting.
"Don't good morning me, Tenik. I've just received news of another explosion. At least 13 soldiers dead or wounded down in Lower Landfall."
Tenik stepped down beside Mikkel and scowled. "I'm sure that Yaret has been informed."
"Has he?"
Fugula took a half step toward Tenik, "because his cupbearer is attending a game with a foreigner instead of out there looking for the men killing our troops."
Mikkel bit his tongue.
She had no idea she'd been followed the other day, and he had to resist the urge to throw her meeting with Mahush back in her face. He could see the same struggle on Tenik's face.
You've no right to question Tenek's actions, Mikkel said.
Why is he talking to me?
Fagula asked Tenek.
Mikkel felt his heat rising, and before Tenek could answer, he said, Why can't you ask me? You were good enough to attack an unarmed man, but too good to talk to him.
His jaw snapped shut at the end of the sentence, and he immediately regretted opening his mouth. But, as his mother liked to say, in for a penny, in for a krana.
Fagula's nostrils flared. Silence your new pet, Tenek.
Silence yourself, Tenek said. Mikkel, it seemed, wasn't the only one sick of Fagula's shit. Tenek crossed his arms, staring her down. He's right. You've no place questioning what I do and how I do it. My household is combing the city for the Empire's enemies, while Sediel ignores our pleas for more soldiers. This foreigner has handed us more enemy agents in the last few days than anyone in your household.
You have no idea the sacrifices my household makes to hold this city,
Fagula hissed. She turned her nose up.
I won't speak another word in the foreigner's presence.
Mikkel noted that the room had grown silent. Well over 100 sets of eyes were watching the confrontation. Whispers had already begun, and he thought he saw money change hands somewhere in the crowd. The Dainais, it seemed, enjoyed a good show as much as any Cressian.
You're a damned coward, Mikkel told her. Fagula's eyes widened slightly. In Fatrasta, coward was a trigger word to start a fight. She glared at him, but did not move. Slime? She retorted.
Mikkel sought his memory for the worst Palo insults his mother had taught him as a boy.
Horse-eater, he threw back at her.
There was a sharp intake of breath from the watching Dionys. Someone behind Mikkel swore, while a woman in the crowd laughed out loud. Fagula's arm jerked stiffly, and the moment Mikkel had been waiting for arrived. Her blackjack came to hand, and she swung her arm. Mikkel barely got his own arm up in time to keep the blow from hitting him below the eye. His forearm went numb, and he couldn't help but gasp at the pain that shot down his arm. He stumbled into her, his numb hand grasping, without feeling, at her jacket. With the other hand, he dipped into his pocket and slipped his fingers into his knuckle dusters. She shoved him backward, then raised her blackjack one more time. Mikkel's jab with his knuckle dusters was hurried and sloppy, but he still managed to catch her a glancing blow on the chin that sent her wide-eyed and reeling into the arms of her companions. Someone to Mikkel's right kicked him hard in the side of the knee. He nearly toppled to the ground, not letting himself take his eyes off Fagula, as Tenek suddenly dove into the middle of the chaos and shouted for silence. Mikkel felt Tenek grab him by the sleeves and jerk him along, half pulling, half dragging him through the crowd, and out a side door into a narrow corridor. He was shoved into a chair and left while Tenek ran back inside.
Tenek returned a moment later.
"What the pit did you think you were doing provoking her like that?" he hissed.
It was the first time Mikkel had seen Tenek genuinely angry. They were alone in this corridor, and Mikkel let himself lean back and test his numb arm, wincing in pain.
"Ow!" he responded. "You're lucky she didn't stave your head in," Tenek said. "You're lucky you..."
Tenek stopped, looked closely at Mikkel, then gasped.
You did that on purpose.
Mikkel forced himself to chuckle. He didn't feel it, not with the pain shooting up his left arm.
Why?
Tenek demanded.
I wanted to see how easily she was provoked,
Mikkel answered.
I could have told you that.
I also wanted to make it very clear to her that I hit back. Mikkel worked the knuckle dusters off his fingers and waved them at Tenek before putting them back in his pocket. He reached into the opposite pocket with the numb fingers of the other hand and showed Tenek a thick leather booklet.
And I wanted the chance to steal her pocketbook.
Like Pitt?
Tenek stared at him for several moments. How did you know she carried one?
I saw her writing it earlier.
If she realizes that you...
She already wants to kill me, Mikhail said. I can see it in her eyes. She's not going to admit to anyone that I stole from her, so what's the harm?
Fugula can do a lot of harm, Tenek warned.
Mikhail leaned back on the bench, cradling his damaged arm, hoping the feeling would come back soon.
I haven't picked a pocket for a couple of years. Still have a talent for it, though, even with numb fingers.
You disgust me.
There was a note of respect in Tenek's voice. Mikhail decided he only half meant it. Before Mikhail could retort, the door to the foreign dignitary room opened, and Mikhail swallowed whatever he had to say. Shane Ectracia, the granddaughter of Yaret's political enemy and a damned privileged sorcerer, stepped into the hall and closed the door behind her. She tilted her head to one side, pulling a wry face, and stared at Mikhail. Mikhail glanced at Tenek, hoping he'd step in with some excuse, and, when no such help was forthcoming, attempted a furtive glance towards the closest exit.
"Mikhail Bravis, was it?"
Ectracia asked. She spoke in perfect Adran, catching Mikhail off guard. Mikhail's mouth was dry.
"That's me."
Ectracia let out a giggle. A damned giggle. And Mikhail realized she'd been the one to laugh when he called Fugula a horse-eater.
"I haven't seen someone hit Fugula since I was a little girl."
She clapped her hands, slowly, the grin on her face speaking volumes of both respect and pity.
"I think the woman who struck her ended up strangled in the bath."
Tenek cleared his throat.
"Sheen, we're sorry for causing such a commotion. We..."
Ectracia held up a finger toward Tenek without even looking at him.
He snapped his mouth shut.
"Mikhail," Ectracia said, "I won't keep you any longer. I just wanted you to know that you made me laugh. Good afternoon."
She turned and swept down the hall without another word, leaving Mikhail with a hammering heart and a good view of her hips as she walked away. She was well gone when Tenek said in a low voice,
"I warned you about catching her attention."
"Believe me when I say I'd no intention of doing so."
"Shit, shit, shit."
Mikhail got to his feet, trying to shake the numbness out of his arm, and only receiving another jolt of pain for his efforts. Between Hendra's and Fugula, his damned arm had taken a beating the last 2 weeks. He forced himself to put Ectracia out of his mind and held up Fugula's wallet.
"Let's go somewhere private and see what we can find out about our friend."
Chapter 26. Vlora spent the next several days scouting up and down the numerous valleys that led into the mountains from Yellow Creek. They varied in size, from immense canyons big enough to march a field army through, to little crags and gullies that were hard to spot unless you were right on top of them. The biggest were filled to the brim with prospectors, larger mines up the side of the canyon belonging to either Jesse or Bert, and the streams filled with independent panners hoping to make it rich on gold dust. Laura created a system in her head, starting with the largest and busiest canyon, and then working clockwise around Yellow Creek. It was slow going, searching everywhere without looking like she was searching everywhere, and then doing the whole thing again with her sorcerous senses. So much time spent in the Else exhausted her, leaving her strung out at the end of each day with barely enough wits about her to keep an eye out for Jesse and Bert's goons, or for the powder mage Bert had warned her about.
She talked to 100 prospectors each day under the guise of looking for a quiet but well-paying job, and had heard enough gossip from them to fill an entire lifetime. Everyone had news of the distant war, that the loss of landfall was enemy propaganda, that Lindet had been captured and hanged by the Dianais, and everyone had an opinion on Bert and Jesse. Between the two, everyone agreed, Jesse was the more heavy-handed but had more money. People seemed to like Bert, but in most Cressian's eyes he was still a filthy palo. She returned from the hills on the fourth day with her eyes bloodshot and her feet hurting. 17 prospectors had offered her a job, most of them on behalf of the two big bosses, and no less than twice that many had offered graphic descriptions of what their sex life would be like if she followed them back to their tent. She was irritable and coming up empty-handed, and it did not improve her mood when a man of about 30 fell into step beside her as she headed toward her hotel through the Palo district. He was nearly 6 feet tall, with blonde hair and blue eyes, a wide, pleasant face wrinkled from scars and smile lines, a broad-shouldered build that made her think of Roosevelian sailors. He carried a pistol and sword, and wore a bicorn and red bandana with a loose-fitting white shirt, sailor's boots, and a long-tailed dressing coat that had seen better days. He looked like a damn storybook pirate. But what caught Vlora's attention was not the way he was dressed, but rather the way he smelled. He reeked of black powder, and she barely had to touch her sorcerer's senses to know that this man was a powder mage. She kept walking, pretending she hadn't noticed him, and let her hand fall on the pommel of her sword. She pushed away her exhaustion, senses prepared, her heart beating quickly. She'd never fought a powder mage before, not for real. She'd sparred and practiced, and she'd considered all the theories about what a fight between two mages would entail, but never before engaged in true combat. As she looked up from her thoughts, she found herself shocked that he was walking beside her, instead of putting a bullet in her head from across town. "It's a lovely evening," he said, clearing his throat. Laura stopped, turning toward him, putting her best card-playing face forward. "What do you want?" He offered his hand. "My name is Noan. Pleased to meet you." Hesitantly, expecting a trap, Vlora took his hand. He squeezed a bit too hard, with too broad of a smile, and Vlora snatched back her hand and watched him cautiously. "Verundish, what do you want? Can I buy your drink?" It was not a question Vlora expected, but her immediate thought was to get this man off the street and out of the open. If this came to a fight, she would have to do things that would not easily be explained to onlookers. "Sure," she said, nodding to a bar across the street. "There." The bar was obviously a Palo establishment, but it was small and nearly empty, and the proprietor didn't question them when they ordered drinks. "You're Adran," Noan observed after they'd been served. Laura tried to guess his accent. "And you're Starlish?" He nodded. "Very good. I wouldn't have expected to see an Adran powder mage in this part of the world. You here with those mercenaries down south?" His tone was light, even friendly, and Vlora tried to loosen the knot in between her shoulder blades. Tensing up would not help things if this came to a fight. "Avoiding them, more like," she answered.
"Understandable. That General Flint is a real bitch. You don't want to cross her. She'll try to recruit you and kill you if she can't."
Vlora barely resisted laughing in his face.
"Is that so? I've never met her."
"I have," Noan said, using the opportunity to lower his voice and move a little closer. "Her goons chased me halfway across Adro a few years ago when I told them I wasn't interested in joining her cabal.
No kidding.
Flora's mind raced, trying to remember if any such thing had ever happened.
She'd never seen this man before in her life, but the name was vaguely familiar.
Had one of her underlings gotten into a scrap with him?
No kidding,
no one confirmed. He put money on the bar, enough for both their drinks, and clinked his against hers.
But I got to stay independent, if you know what I mean. More money in that.
Flora fiddled with a drink, hoping that he wasn't smart enough to plan ahead and have her poisoned. She had picked the bar, so she doubted that.
So, you're the other mage in town, eh?
Aside from you and your boyfriend, yeah.
He's just my partner, Flora said. She realized her mistake too late, as Noan's eyes moved up and down her body. His nose twitched, and he none too subtly removed a powder charge from his breast pocket and cut the end with his thumb, sniffing delicately. Flora did the same, almost laughing at the thought of a powder mage after dinner club, where they all sat around drinking and running powder trances. She could see the thoughts turning in his head, and decided to press her own questions before he could come on to her.
I'm told you're working for Jesse.
That's right.
I spoke with Bert a few nights ago. I think he pays a lot more than Jesse.
He might, Owen admitted. I didn't check. But Jesse's got the upper hand. I like to get paid and end up on the winning side.
I'm guessing you know that I already turned Jesse down, right?
Flora asked.
No one barked a laugh. Heard what you did to poor Donna. Your partner did him a favor, skewering him. Living a life with no tongue.
He clicked his tongue twice, then laughed again. The sound was tinged with cruelty.
I turned down Bert, too, if that's why you're here. I'm not interested in working for either of them, so you can go back to your boss and tell her.
Flora finished her glass and raised it to Noan.
I appreciate the drink, but I'm not for sale.
She turned to go, deciding it was best to withdraw from this before he could get a chance to try for blood.
Noan snatched her by the arm. That's not why I'm here, lover.
Excuse me.
Flora felt her chest grow tight. His grip was too firm, his tone too familiar.
I'm here to offer you and your partner something a little different.
Which is?
No one leaned forward until their faces were almost touching and spoke in a low, conspiratorial tone.
We've got 3 powder mages here. 3 of us. We could gut this whole damn town. Pick 'em off. Cut 'em down. Doesn't matter how, we've got the strength.
I'm not sure what you're suggesting,
Flora said, though she had an inkling. The sparkle in no one's eye when he said, cut 'em down, was just a little too obvious.
I'm talking a slaughter. We take out the big bosses, get their 2 armies fighting each other, and we set fire to the town and go a-hunting. We kill everything with 2 legs, and there'll be no one to stop us from loading up a mule train with gold and heading for the coast. We'll be in Gerla living like kings before anyone knows what's happened.
Flora's fingers itched for her sword.
That's quite an offer.
I know,
he said with a grin.
You already took Jesse's coin.
So?
If you're willing to betray one partner, why the pit would I trust you?
No one tightened his grip on her arm. Because you're strong. You're a mage, like me. I'm not stupid. I won't betray someone who can fight back.
Laura looked down at his hand on her arm for several long seconds. When she decided she'd calmed down, she jerked away from his grasp.
That's about the most cowardly thing I've ever heard someone say.
Noan's grin disappeared. His expression changed to baffled, then disgusted in an instant.
What are you, some kind of hero? Nobody gets anything in this life they don't take with force. And we've got the force to take it.
I work for my money, thank you, Flora said quietly. I'm not a cowardly dog, biting the hand and stealing the scraps.
Bitch, no one snarled.
I've been called worse by better.
It didn't surprise her when no one took a swing. Flora caught his wrist, but was forced back a step by the power of the blow. He was running a powder trance, just like her, and was physically much larger. Her sorcery wasn't an advantage here. He moved quickly, swinging his other hand with the glass still in it. She ducked, kicking out his leg, the glass catching her a glancing blow across the back of the head. She heard the sound of the glass shattering, and brought her fist up hard and fast, connecting with his chin with enough force to lift him off the ground and lay any grown man out cold. He caught himself on a table, shaking off a daze, and came at her quick. Only preternatural senses allowed her to sense the movement of his sorcery, leaping out to set off her powder like a finger on a hair trigger. She fought back mentally, suppressing his ability to detonate powder with her mind, while fending off a series of powerful blows that sent her retreating across the bar. The bartender leapt into a back room, slamming the door, while the few occupants cleared out. Noan's fingers went for her throat, and Flora kneed him between the legs and grabbed the lapels of his jacket, swinging him around and into the beam holding up the roof with enough force that there was an audible crack. Once again, Noan shook it off. He regained his feet and fell into a boxer's stance, one fist forward.
"I gave you a chance," he said, jabbing.
Flora jerked back from the bow, imitating his stance and slamming her fist into his gut three times before he could get an arm around her head and throw her away from him. She hit the bar head first, seeing stars, and barely recovered before he came at her again. She held her arms up in a defensive posture, taking a pummeling, before getting an opening of her own and grabbing him by the throat. She lifted him over her head, powering forward, and slammed him through a table with all her strength. She didn't bother going for her pistol. Both of them could prevent powder from igniting a spark. Instead, she drew her sword and leapt toward him, intent on putting a blade through his eye. He was quick, snapping away from the thrust and rolling to his feet. He struggled to draw his own sword as he dodged Flora's thrusts. Flora became more frustrated. She'd fought a lot of quick people and sparred with powder mages, but the frustration of having someone dodge your attack so easily mounted quickly. The irony, she realized in the back of her head, was not enjoyable. She missed on a thrust, and Noan kicked her hard in the chest, sending her reeling across the bar. He finally drew his own sword, but made no motion to advance. They both panted from the fight.
"I was a member of the Starlish Cabal," he said. "We could have worked well together, but you passed up a chance at real riches."
He spat at her feet. "Watch your back." Without warning, he suddenly broke and ran, pushing his way out the door and into the street. Flora considered giving chase, but her leg hurt from a kick to her shin, and her vision was slightly blurry. She felt the back of her head where the glass had broken, only for her fingers to come away covered in crimson. Finding her hat in the ruin of the barroom, she limped out the door and into the street. She was almost to her hotel when she spotted a face in the crowd. It touched something in the back of her memory, but she couldn't quite put her finger on it. It was almost an hour later, when she'd cleaned herself up and retreated to her room, that the face suddenly attached itself to a name. She swore loudly, feeling furious that she hadn't recognized him earlier. Prime Lector, former Dean of Adapest University and one-time ally of Field Marshal Tamas, was a powerful, immortal privileged who disappeared during the Adrankes War over 10 years ago. What kind of terrible bloody luck did she have for him to show up here now? Seeing someone like Prime Lecter in the same town as a Godstone couldn't possibly be a coincidence.
Chapter 27
Belport is under siege.
Stike jerked awake, realizing he'd been nodding off at the reins and blinked the sleep out of his eyes. The Mad Lancers stretched down the road in a column behind and ahead of him, with Jackal and his banner a dozen paces back, and Ibana nowhere to be seen. Selene and Carpole rode together nearby, the latter teaching Selene her sign language. Stike yawned and turned toward the woman addressing him. He didn't know her name, but she wore the crimson and blue of the Riflejack Cavalry, and she waited for an answer with a cool, professional air.
"How far out are we?"
he asked, casting about for a landmark that he might recognize.
"Less than 5 miles."
Stike considered his options. They could swing down south, skirting Belport and the Dionysus army, and be well past them by noon tomorrow. But Belport was their last chance to rest and resupply before heading out onto the Hammer, and it was a good place to recruit. And there was the matter of the traitor Valyane. Perhaps he should just get that over with.
"Take me to Gusta," Stike told her.
Stike ordered a halt and rode ahead with the messenger, finding Gusta and a group of his dragoons hidden in a glen about 2 miles to the east of Belltower. Stike left his horse and climbed to the lip of the nearest hill, where Gusta was crouched among the shrubbery with a looking-glass in hand. He offered it to Stike as he approached. Belport was a coastal city located at the mouth of a small, swift-moving river. Its port was built behind a tall hill that effectively protected the city from a seaward attack, and the north side was watched over by a stone fortress built by the Starlish almost 200 years ago. The gun towers were outdated but effective, forcing an enemy army to approach from the south. This seemed to suit the Dionysus just fine. They were camped just under a mile south of the river, bombarding the suburbs and old city walls with artillery, and the sorcery of what looked to be a single privileged. Stike guessed the army at about 5,000 infantry and a few hundred cavalry support. They were camped on the sandy floodplain, and he amused himself with the thought of torrential rain carrying them all into the ocean. Unfortunately, the weather was sunny and the ground dry.
"I can't imagine the garrison lasting much longer," Gustav said. "A day, maybe two at best."
He pointed to a smouldering ruin in the corner of the city where the river let into the ocean.
"That was their biggest south-facing gun tower, and it went down about 2 hours ago. Bell Tower has a few 4-pounders on that hill over there," he pointed again, "but nothing else outside the old fortress. Once they go down, the Dionysus just have to cross the river."
"So you think they're done for?" Stike asked.
From what he could see, he didn't disagree. Gusta nodded.
"Unless we intervene soon, the smart option is to head around to the south and be past them by tomorrow night. They'll be too busy securing the city to chase us, and they've only got a few hundred cavalry anyway."
Stike twirled his lancer's ring, considering. There was a lot of smoke rising from the southern suburbs, but the northern half of the city was still untouched and full of people he could save.
"I don't want to leave an enemy behind us," he said. "The Dionysus already have Swinshire. If we let them take Belport, we'll be completely cut off on the Hammer."
To his surprise, Gustav smiled.
"I was hoping you'd say that. Hit 'em from the rear, and they won't see what's coming. I'm only worried about the privileged. We don't have a powder mage to put a bullet in their head."
Stike handed Gustav back his looking-glass.
"Leave the privilege to me."
The Mad Lancers swung south, using the hills beyond the floodplain as cover, and coming up directly behind the Dynai's position to slam into their supply train at a gallop. Stike gave the order to keep formation tight, and only slow enough to kill anyone who raised a weapon. Then they came over the hills and found